I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. 1 month ago tomorrow, I talked to the distinguished writer Pico Iyer. He was in Toronto for an appearance, and we discussed his new book, A Beginner's Guide to Japan, Observations and Provocations. It's a fascinating book featuring thoughts Mr. Iyer has about Japan, a country he has lived in for more than 30 years. It's a country that feels like home for him, yet can still feel foreign. It's a country, one realizes as they read the book, that has a lot of contradictions, and that's where the writer in Mr. Iyer revels in and reveals much of the character and society of the Japanese. This book is a companion to his most recent book, Autumn Light, which was also released earlier this year. That book is a memoir on recent times in Mr. Iyer's life. He ruminates on life itself as he returns to Japan, where he shares a home with his wife, as her father has just died. It's a beautiful book on holding on to what's close and seeing what falls away as we get older. These two books, taken in tandem, share so much about how unique life is in Japan and how Pico Iyer has made a home there. Pico Iyer is described as the greatest living travel writer, which I'll ask him about. He's the author of more than a dozen books, which have been translated into 23 languages. His four recent TED Talks have received more than 8 million views so far. This past summer, he was the Ferris Professor of Journalism at Princeton, guest director of the Telluride Film Festival, and the first official writer-in-residence at the Raffles Hotel in Singapore. An essayist in Time magazine since 1986, he's regularly read in the New York Times, a New York Review of Books, Granta, and many other publications. Visit PicoIyerJourneys.com. This new book is published by Knopf. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Pico Iyer. Mr. Iyer, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Very well, thank you.
As I was telling you, I loved Autumn Light a great deal, and I've enjoyed this book equally as much because I guess they're companions, aren't they?
Yes, they're almost like brother and sister books. And, you know, I think whenever you feel really strongly about a person or a place or any subject, you have very competing, even contradictory responses to them. So you're in love with them at 3 in the morning and you're impatient with them at 2 in the afternoon and then you're in love with them at 6 in the evening. So I wanted to give voice to both these feelings that I have towards my companion of 32 years, Japan.
And that's the thing, even before moving there, or going there 32 years ago, it's a place that has been in your mind. It's something that at an early age, you know, it seized your imagination, didn't it?
It did. I mean, in this most mysterious way, before I'd ever been there, I felt as if it was my home in some way. And then the first time I ever set foot in Japan is 1983. I was just on a 20-hour layover at Narita Airport near Tokyo. And to kill time waiting for my flight, I just spent a couple of hours walking around the airport town of Narita. And on the basis of 2 hours in an airport town, I decided to throw over my comfortable-seeming life in New York and move to Japan. And I think I write about that a bit because I suspect all of us have secret homes, the way that you'll meet a stranger and you feel as if you've known her forever. But I was lucky enough to find my secret home at an early age and to take myself there quite soon.
What was it that fascinated you or interested you about Japan that made you want to, say, throw in your lot there, if you will?
Well, I could give you many explanations, but I wouldn't actually believe them because I think the nature of affinity is that it exists in some non-rational sphere. So I remember that day I was walking around Narita. It was late October, which means in Japan, brilliantly blue skies, and the first pang of coming cold and the approach of winter in the darkness. And something in that mix of radiance and melancholy, which is, of course, the theme of my first book, really pierced me. And I thought, my goodness, something about this place, I feel I know even better than I know the town where I grew up in England or the apartment where I lived in New York City. And I thought, if I don't come back here, something in me is always going to be unresolved. And maybe I'll come to the end of my life and think I'm almost dead and I've never really lived. So it was like a summons from some mysterious part of me. And I could tell you that Japan is a little bit like the England where I grew up, but it's exotic and indecipherable, so it's like an intoxicating version of home. Or I could tell you it's very different from India, which is where my parents come from and where my DNA comes from. and very different from California, which is my other official home. But as I say, I don't think the reasons are as important as just that intuition that this place makes sense to me and it understands me and I understand it somehow for no reason at all, really.
And that's the thing that just as one begins the book, even one can't help but confront the idea of contradictions as you write about them and about this place. Because I mean, in one instance, you can say something definitive about the place or the people, and then even in the next paragraph, you've contradicted yourself. Is that the case with Japan or parts of Asia, say, or is that could that be anywhere? Could that be New York? Could that be Vancouver or Toronto, where you are today?
What a good question. At some level, it could be anywhere, but I think it's uniquely Japanese, and I'm so glad you noticed that, and that's the reason why I wrote two contradictory books at the same time, and as you were suggesting, everything that you read in the first book might be upended by the second, and they actually say in Kyoto, every reverse has reverse, which is, I suppose, a reminder that, you know, all our thoughts are provisional, and even our feelings are very temporary. I feel a certain way talking to you now, and I know 2 hours from now I'll feel a different way, and that's not so much a contradiction, or if it as a change in the weather, and the weather's constantly shifting, but it's always the same sky. And I think what we think of as contradiction, the Japanese more naturally think of as complementarity. They don't see things in either-or terms. So, for example, the example many people use is if you go to Japan in the last week of the year, this year, on Christmas Eve, you'll see hundreds of thousands of Japanese flocking into Christian churches to listen to Bach and Beethoven and Handel. And then 1 week later, on New Year's Eve, you'll see them all going to the Buddhist temple to watch a old bronze bell being struck 108 times to mark the passing of the year. And then a few hours after that, you'll see them go to the Shinto shrine to set an auspicious note for the new year. And we will say, well, wait a minute, this sounds like a contradiction. How can they so wholeheartedly go in the same 8 days to a Christian church, a Buddhist temple, and a Shinto shrine? And they would say each of them serves a different function. And it's the way that many of us might go to our fathers for one thing and to our mothers for another thing and to our sisters for a third thing. Those aren't exactly contradictions so much as many different factors play a part in our life and each one is speaking to a different need or a different context. And so really I'd say maybe the truest contradiction in Japan is just the one between surface and depth. And things look one way, but they... in truth, they're very different. And again, as I was saying about the sky and the weather, in Kyoto they sometimes say the river is always moving, but it's always the same river. And is that a contradiction? Well, not exactly. It's just a fact of life.
Right. You've just explained a poll that you cite in the book about religion. Or the practice of religion. It's more than 10 years old now, but it's 25% or 1 in 4 believe in a religion, say, in Japan, yet 96% have participated in some kind of religious rite.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about faith and the Japanese and their subscription to faith. Has that changed at all, those figures? And what does that say about what they want to believe in? Because, as you just said, it going to one place or another might contradict, you know, each other, but still, they go.
They go. And so I think what it says is that religion in Japan, like many things in Japan, is more a matter of ritual than belief. And in fact, the main religions, Shinto, which is a kind of animist religion, there are no texts, there are no theologies there. There are no sacred scriptures. Buddhism, as it comes to Japan, is much less about teachings and philosophical ideas than just about practices. And to give an example, I think there's a sanity and a wisdom in that, very practical culture. Last year, my Japanese mother-in-law died. And as soon as she died, of course, the emotions inside my wife and the rest of the family were the same that they would be in Vancouver or Toronto. But anger, frustration, sorrow, all that. But in Japan, you're given a set code of rituals to follow, that within 24 hours the body is cremated, that my wife had to go and buy a sacred Buddhist name to protect her mother in the afterworld. She had to buy a very expensive gravestone. 7 days later, the priest visits the house and chants. 1 year later, the priest comes again. And I think in these moments of confusion, which are many of the moments in our life, it's so handy to be told what to do. It doesn't change the fact that people are grieving or are confused or upset, but it tells them how to hit their marks and how to go through the initial days as slowly they make their peace with their feelings. And as I say, I think there's a sort of wisdom in that. I would say that Japan is not a culture of abstractions or ideas, but very much of real-world actions, and the religion is a part of that. And that's why I sometimes tell my friends, if they're coming to Japan, I see one of the founding religions of Japan just being the seasons, which is why I wrote a whole book on autumn, mm-hmm. which are teaching us about changelessness and change, and that everything's in movement, and we're all getting a little bit older and moving towards winter, but at the same time as we get into winter, we're moving back towards spring again. And for example, I describe in the book how the Dalai Lama comes to Japan every year, and his brand of Tibetan Buddhism is very analytical, and it would fit into any philosophical department at UBC or the U of T. But Japanese Buddhism is much more an aspect of a matter of practice and what you do rather than what you think. So, yes, I think that statistic you cited is perfect. My neighbors and my wife don't have much interest in what is God, what is the hereafter, existential issues, but they do have a set of practices to guide them as they're going through the world.
The other thing that one gets, you talk about this early in the book, is this sort of builds into what you just said. It's how the Japanese have, I guess, how they view themselves and how they're viewed by others plays a part in how they comport themselves. And you tell the story of how your wife dresses up, or when she dresses up, and as opposed to when she doesn't. And I think that's a marvelous insight into to how they see themselves.
Yes. Well, so as you know, the Japanese have a different word for the self that exists behind closed doors from the self that's loose in the world. And I think they assume there need be no connection between them. So I was very struck after meeting my Japanese wife to notice that if it's 6:15 in the morning and she's just going to the convenience store down the street, she will dress herself as formally as if she were going to a cocktail party. And to me, that seems very unnecessary, but to her, she's going out into public and she has certain responsibilities akin to wearing black when you go to a funeral or speaking in complete sentences if somebody approaches you on the street. And conversely, when she's at home, even if guests are visiting our house for dinner and it's a semi-formal occasion, she'll think nothing of racing around without makeup in bare feet and jeans, because this is the home, and she occupies one self in the home, and she occupies a different self when she's out in the world. And again, it speaks to that theme of contradiction. It's not that the selves contradict each other, but that the Japanese are very sensitive to context, and in a very different way from us. So they believe that there's one code of behavior in the office, another code at home, another code when you're at the convenience store. And of course, we practice a similar version of that, but not as refined and not as sophisticated as that, maybe.
Yeah, and so it's this idea of people playing a part every day. I mean, that's something that as you walk down the street, you can see that, right?
Yes, very much. And when I step into the subway station, some people are dressed as wild punks, so they're probably very law-abiding citizens. Some are dressed as stately matrons, so they're probably very unlaw-abiding citizens. And it's a good reminder in Japan that you can't judge any book by its cover, and that even after 32 years in the country, I look at a woman dressed in a cardigan with pearls, and I think, oh, she looks very respectable, and my wife will say, oh no, she's the wildest person around. And I'll look at somebody who's dressed like Johnny Rotten, and my wife will say, oh yes, that person's never had a boyfriend or a girlfriend. That's the most respectable person going. So it's a good reminder that that in Japan, playing a part is a form of taking responsibility and doing your bit by society. And I think I cite in my second book, The Beginner's Guide to Japan, how if you go into a fancy restaurant and the maitre d' is not dressed in a tuxedo and black tie, but in fact in torn jeans and a T-shirt, even we might feel, well, he's not doing his bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're paying $60 to have this fancy meal, and it goes with a certain set of expectations, and he ought to be dressed formally because this is a formal dinner that we're taking our grandmother out for her birthday or whatever. And so the Japanese have that same sense, but it pertains to every aspect of life, which means that it's very hard to know where you stand with them and what is the distance, what's the distance between what they're saying or what they're playing and what they really feel. And the fact that even after all these years, I can't exactly tell what's going on is part of what I find so fascinating. I think it's a very layered society, and I love the fact that I can't assume I'm on top of things there.
What is your year breakdown in terms of how much time you spend there?
If I had my absolute wish, I would spend every hour of my life and year there. Practically speaking, I spend about 7 months of the year, autumn, winter, and a little bit of spring. I have an elderly mother in California, so that means I have to go and want to go and spend time with her.
Uh-huh.
And also my job involves my being in Toronto as I'm talking to you and being in Vancouver a couple of months ago, so it takes me away from Japan. But nowhere I visit is ever as involving as Japan is.
Yeah,
always kind.
Yeah, and it reminds me of that moment in the book where you're waiting for an elevator with Meryl Streep.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about going home. I guess Japan is. Does that feel like home for you?
It really does.
Yeah.
I've lived there by choice for 32 years on a tourist visa, but it's the deepest home I could ever hope to find. I spent my first 21 years in England, but that became the place I wanted to run away from. And I'm 100% Indian by background and ancestry,
mm-hmm.
but I've never lived there. I don't speak a word of any Indian language except English. I've been officially resident in the United States for more than 50 years, but that doesn't make me feel like an American. And I think home is really based on intangible things, much less which passport you carry or which house you occupy, than which place is on your wavelength, which place makes sense to you, and which place do you feel your truest self. And that's very much Japan. And it's funny because if my Japanese wife were to talk to you, she would say, and this is quite typical nowadays, that she is a Japanese person, is a real Indian in the household. She's very brightly colored and gregarious and warm, and that I'm the Japanese in the household, who's very kind of, you know, shy and by the book, and, you know, the 6:15 train has to arrive at 6:15.
Have you noticed in your 32 years there, changes in terms of the attitude of the Japanese? And I guess my real question is how much American influence has there been in that country in these past 32 years?
I would say huge American influence on the surface and amazingly little deep down.
Hmm.
And I think I really think of Japan almost as an old man in a Planet Hollywood T-shirt. So you know, he's wearing very cool global fashions. He's up to the moment. He's wearing this cutting-edge American thing, but it doesn't make him any less old and any less Japanese. And, for example, even my wife, she sells semi-punky English clothes. She wears black leather jackets and roars around on a motorbike. But every morning before dawn, she wakes up very early. She heats water to make her father's favorite cup of tea and puts it out for her father on the household altar, even though her father died 6 years ago. So if you were to meet her, you'd say, oh, this is just like a typical young woman from Toronto, Vancouver, or Los Angeles. But if you were to talk to her, you'd quickly realize this is like a woman from 8th century Japan who's observing all the Shinto and Buddhist rites we associate with 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So my Japanese neighbors are very worried that they're turning American, but I think the challenge of Japan is it's, as it were, not global enough. It's not American, and it's almost its own planet, deep down, I would say.
And I guess that's where you find comfort, isn't it? The familiar, if you will.
It's where I find fascination. So
yeah.
I would say that geopolitically, Japan is suffering because it doesn't speak the language of the rest of the world, metaphorically or literally. Statistically, English language proficiency in Japan is lower than in North Korea or Tajikistan or Cambodia or Nepal. Much, much less sophisticated, less developed countries speak much better English. And so that hasn't helped Japan in the economic sphere, but it has kept Japan deeply Japanese. And so, yes, as you were saying, for a visitor, it remains fascinating because it doesn't look or feel like anywhere else. And even if you've spent your whole life in Canada or the U.S., when you arrive there, you'll see baseball stadiums everywhere.
Yeah.
And then you find out that the baseball game in Japan ends in a tie if the score is level after 12 innings. And that the teams are therefore not trying to win, that they're trying not to lose.
Mm.
And then you realize, this is a very North American surface, but it's become something absolutely Japanese.
The relationship of the outdoors is fascinating because I think there's something instructive there for us when we're thinking of the huge issue of climate change. What might we learn from the Japanese in that regard? I mean, you spoke a moment ago of viewing the world as not either or. And I think that viewing it as one, there's something instructive there for us, isn't there?
I think there is, absolutely. And I mentioned in the first book, Autumn Light, how my wife will tell me that when she was a little girl, 6 years old, and she was sitting at the family dinner table, if she kicked the table, as many a six-year-old might,
sure,
her father would say, "You have to apologize to that table because that table has a soul, and that table has done nothing to hit you or to hurt you. Why are you angry with the table? Kicking the table is like kicking your brother." And it took me a long time after I got to Japan to realize that every pencil, every desk, every piece of paper for the Japanese has a spirit. And that's partly why, theoretically at least, they pay so much respect to everything around them. And a book has the same existence almost for them and the same degree of soulfulness as another human being. Now, in practice, of course, they don't always treat their nature well. There's a lot of littering in Japan, and there are many things they're not doing well. But I think you see this in the films of the great Japanese director Hayao Miyazaki, who's won a couple of Academy Awards for Spirited Away and The Wind Rises. He's showing us a world in which, when you look at a forest, the blades of grass have spirits, have souls. Mm. Everything around is alive, and therefore you treat them with as much respect as you would your fellow human beings. And I think in the environmental context, a lot of traditional indigenous societies that have more of this pantheistic notion or viewpoint that everything is alive do have something to teach us, because we make these very hard and fast distinctions between animate and inanimate, which they don't believe in at all.
Yeah, that's what Marie Kondo tells us when we throw away our teddy bear. To cover its eyes, right?
Exactly, that's right. And ask your two-piece or one-piece dress if it's sparking joy. And most of us wouldn't think of talking to our dresses. And I think when my Japanese neighbors hear about Marie Kondo, they think, what's the big deal? That's what we do anyway. And just a couple of weeks ago, I was in a train with my wife, and she suddenly said, "This train's name is Tom. This elevator's name is Harry." And as soon as she said that, I honestly was thinking of the elevator in slightly different ways.
Mm.
It wasn't just this impersonal machine transporting me from the sixth floor to the third floor.
Yeah.
It was something with personality. And I'm always grateful to her for that kind of shift in attitude.
Yeah. Speaking of shifts in attitude, you mentioned a filmmaker a moment ago. A lot of us have seen Shoplifters in the last year or so, and you write in the book that shocked a lot of people because of the concept, of how it depicted the concept of family and how that's changed. I mean, is there something that's inherently changed in how, say, people view one another in Japan, I guess that's why the film depicts what it does?
Well, I really loved that movie,
and
it was the best movie I saw all of 2018. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think it speaks to the Japanese worry I was mentioning a couple of minutes ago. They're worried that the family is fracturing. And I remember the same director made a film called After the Storm, which centers around a writer, and it's a writer who's written a book called The Empty Table. And I think the fear of the empty table, the splintered family, the family where the daughter has married a Canadian and is living in Vancouver and the son has moved to Tokyo and the old parents are alone, that's a big worry in Japan, which has traditionally had a very keen sense of family, and the family is almost one of the religions of Japan. So it's certainly a great fear for my Japanese neighbors. And you probably heard about this new phenomenon, which has got a lot of play, and which Werner Herzog has just made a movie about, whereby if an elderly Japanese couple doesn't have a daughter to look in on them, they will literally go to an agency and hire an actress to come and visit them every Sunday, and knock on the door and say, "Hi, Mom, hi, Pop, I've really missed you, and let's have a beautiful Sunday afternoon together." And they will suspend disbelief in order to fill that hole in their heart and the fact that their nuclear family has exploded a little, as in that movie. And it sounds very strange to us, but I think to the Japanese that's a practical response to a very real problem. So Shoplifters did such a good job of showing people caring for each other outside the family structure because the basic family had imploded. But it was also, of course, a very sad movie, and I think shocking to many Japanese, because it portrayed a society in which the traditional notion of a family is pretty much gone.
Yeah, and that's reality for a lot of society now, isn't it?
It is. And yeah. For example, my wife got divorced in 1988, and her brother hasn't spoken to the whole family since, because it was such a stigma, and it was so unusual in those days for any Japanese person to get divorced. Pretty much unheard of. And even in the 32 years I've been there, to answer your earlier question, the divorce rate has surged, and now most of my wife's younger female friends have divorced. And in that sense, Japan is moving towards what we're familiar with in North America and Europe, and that's a really haunting concern for the Japanese people, that the divorce rate and the single mom rate would be getting higher and higher with every passing season.
You've been described as the world's greatest traveler. What is it like to hear that?
Strange, because, of course, nobody in my life would believe that, starting with myself. But I've certainly been one of the world's lucky travelers. And, yeah, I've been very fortunate to have spent 45 years traveling everywhere from North Korea to Easter Island, and to some extent been able to make a living and to make a life out of that. But I do feel that one of the big changes in my life is you don't have to go far to travel. And, you know this in Vancouver. If you're interested in most of the cultures in the world, go six blocks down the street in Vancouver, and there is Iran and Bangladesh and Haiti and Somalia. And I think it's a wonderful thing that the world has come to our doorsteps. And so in that sense, you can learn a lot about foreign cultures within our big cities now without having to travel very far.
The other thing I was thinking about as I was thinking of what you do for your work, are you a light packer?
I think relatively light, but of course never as light as I should be.
Yeah.
I always pack more than I need.
Yeah, it's I would have thought after 45 years you would have learned how to do that better. I mean, I don't travel as much as you do, but I mean, I can't pack as you know. I'm always checking in a bag or two. And
yes, and of course it depends on what you're packing. So one of my eccentricities is I've never used a cell phone because I don't want lots of interruption and data in my life, because I feel I've got too much of that already. But the result of not having a cell phone or a Kindle or whatever is I have to pack books. So my luggage, unfortunately, even though I don't take much in the way of clothes, I'm carrying all my books around me, whereas my wiser friends are traveling with Nooks and Kindles and don't need that.
Yeah. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you again, Pico. I love this book, and then, of course, Autumn Light. All the best with these two books. I hope a lot of people pick them up, because there's just a great wisdom in them, and I appreciate your time today.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much, and thank you for reading the books, and thank you for all you do.
Pico Iyer's website is at picoiyerjourneys.com. A Beginner's Guide to Japan, Observations and Provocations is published by Knopf. Pico Iyer, join me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.